Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ben Bernanke's not an exciting guy. He just isn't. And you know what? That's fine, because unexpected creativity is about the last thing you want from the chairman of the Fed. But every now and then, like today, he sneaks a line in a speech that gets everybody's attention. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 8th of July. It's Tuesday. Glad you could be with us. Today's speech by Mr. Bernanke had all the earmarks of being another snoozer, a Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation conference on mortgages. And to give him his due, the Fed chairman stuck to the assigned topic for, about 2 minutes of his half-hour speech. And then he got right to his point that the subprime mess still isn't over with. Ongoing financial turmoil, he called it. And he said the Fed's going to do something about that with new mortgage rules starting next week.
These new rules, which will apply to all lenders and not just banks, will address some of the problems that have surfaced in recent years in mortgage lending, especially for high-cost mortgage lending.
It's those high-cost mortgages, subprimes, another way to say that the Fed's going to target. But Bernanke also said he's open to cracking down on other parts of the financial industry as well. One of the other big bank regulators in this country, besides the Fed, had something to say today, too. Christopher Cox is the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Today, the SEC released its report on credit rating agencies and their role in the subprime mess. Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch are the big ones you've heard of. There are 10 of them in all, though, and they have been criticized harshly for giving top ratings to some of the complicated mortgage-backed securities that tanked after the housing bust. The report Cox made public today spells out just how bad things were at those rating agencies. Marketplace's Amy Scott covers the story for us. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so exactly how bad was it? What did we learn?
Well, this is the SEC's first annual report on the credit rating agencies since Congress gave it express oversight in 2006. And a couple of things stood out to me. One was that the report described just the sheer volume of these complicated deals that these agencies were rating. There was an explosion in both the number and complexity of residential mortgage-backed securities and CDOs, those collateralized debt obligations we've talked about, that the agencies appeared to struggle just to handle the volume. And one email that's quoted in the report, analysts were concerned about whether they should be rating one of these deals. And one said that the firm's model for rating the bond didn't capture half of the deal's risk, but that it could be structured by cows and we would rate it.
Great.
The report also finds that the rating agencies failed to disclose significant aspects of the ratings process. They failed to adequately monitor the ratings after they'd been issued, you know, to make sure a AAA was still really a AAA. And some of the most interesting reading in this report concerns conflicts of interest. You know, the companies that issue these bonds pay the agencies to have them rated. And some of these internal emails suggest that analysts were well aware of the agency's need to win that rating business. And the problem with that is that there's an incentive to give a higher rating than the security might have deserved.
Sure. The SEC has already proposed a bunch of new rules to address some of these complaints. Are we going to get anything new coming out of this report specifically?
Right. Well, last month, you and I talked about this. The commission came out with several proposed reforms that say things like analysts shouldn't help structure the same deals that they rate. They can't accept gifts from issuers worth more than $25. Also, there are rules designed to reduce Wall Street's reliance on credit ratings. This new report makes additional suggestions for the firms, but really it's probably going to just provide additional fodder for the discussion as the SEC considers enacting the rules it proposed.
Mm-hmm. Last question, Amy, before I let you go, a topic that I'm sure is on the minds of many. Anybody going to jail over this whole thing?
Well, the SEC doesn't exactly send people to jail. It does have an enforcement division that could take action if they find fraud. Chairman Cox did say today that when the SEC finds evidence of wrongdoing, it pursues it vigorously. But one securities law professor I spoke to said that the tone of this report didn't really suggest that we'll be seeing any of that.
All right, a big day for securities regulation. Our brand new New York Bureau Chief, Amy Scott, in New York for us. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks, Kai.
In fact, it wasn't just securities regulations that were in the news today. The Bush administration has announced more economic sanctions on Iran. The rules are meant to target Iranian officials and companies accused of helping Tehran develop nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, an investigation made public today by the Associated Press finds American exports to Iran have actually grown tenfold since President Bush took office. From Washington, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains how.
Iran has lived with American sanctions since the 1979 revolution. Some products are still allowed, including agricultural commodities and medicine. That added up to $146 million last year, just a tiny fraction of U.S. exports. But there are indirect exports as well, says Kareem Sajadpour at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Dubai is kind of the giant Swiss cheese hole of these Swiss cheese sanctions.
So the products go through Dubai and then they can come right into Iran?
Exactly. I think anyone who's visited Tehran knows that if you want to find any type of American consumer product, you can.
Sajadpour says Iranians are willing to pay a premium for American goods they love. All the more reason, he says, why sanctions should not include consumer goods.
The more Iranians are exposed to U.S. consumer products, the more they will pressure their government to enter the modern and global economy.
Niall Gardner at the Heritage Foundation has a different view. He says sanctions need to be strengthened across the board to keep Iran from developing its nuclear program.
It's very important, of course, to send a very clear message on several different fronts to the Iranians that the West means business.
But despite that strong message, $148,000 worth of weapons and military gear was shipped from the U.S. to Iran during the Bush presidency. Adam Zubin at the Treasury Department says officials are looking into that.
That's something that would obviously concern us greatly and concern the whole administration.
U.S. sanctions do allow for a few things like rugs to be shipped here from Iran, but the vast majority of Iran's exports are oil. And as long as other countries buy it, it's the ultimate safety net against any sanctions. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Oil was down today, financial stocks were up, and bingo, you got the happy music. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's almost too easy to say that the main result of the G8 meeting in Japan this week has been a lot of hot air. But in this instance, it happens to be true. Today, the leaders of the world's wealthiest nations said they want to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2050. There weren't any shorter-term goals, which has climate campaigners calling the deal not much more than an empty slogan. But there is one industry that's cheering: coal. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Major cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, at least in the long term, became part of the G8's formal statement today. But there's a caveat. World leaders say meeting that goal in an economically sustainable way depends on developing and deploying low-carbon technologies. The G8 statement specifically points to clean coal, where a power plant's greenhouse gas emissions are captured and stored underground, as the primary solution. And the coal industry couldn't be happier. Joe Lucas is with the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity.
It is an absolute endorsement of the fact that meeting the world's growing energy demand is going to require us to continue to rely upon coal to do that.
Lucas supports the G8's call for building 20 demonstration plants in the next few years, despite the fact that the U.S. recently shelved its high-profile clean coal project because of costs. Still, he says the world's abundant coal reserves are key to large-scale clean energy. But environmentalists say the problem is injecting carbon dioxide emissions into the ground on this scale is both expensive and risky.
I think that they are making rosy assumptions about what this technology can actually deliver.
Greenpeace's Kate Smolsky says clean coal is still decades away from becoming a reality. And she says when it comes to avoiding the worst effects of climate change, there aren't decades to spare. Nor is there cash. She says every dollar spent on clean coal means less money for technologies like energy efficiency that can be deployed today. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Clean coal might have a bright future, but today the hydrocarbon of choice lost some ground. Oil closed down more than $5 to almost $136 a barrel, off about $9 from its high last week. OPEC is still doing fine, though. The U.S. Energy Department announced today the oil cartel's profits are going to hit $1.25 trillion this year. Commentator and economic historian John Steele Gordon says whether it's coal, wind, or oil, finding the fuel for our lives is nothing new.
The history of the human consumption of energy has been the searching for and finding of alternative energy sources. Wood was probably the first regular energy source, known and exploited for well over a million years. But when people began to move away from forests, they needed to find a new fuel. What to do? Well, it turned out that animal dung did the trick. But as civilization grew more complex, a better source of work-doing energy than draft animals was needed. By the 3rd century BC, the Greeks and Romans were using the power of falling water, and the Persians invented the windmill about 1,000 years later. In the damp moorlands of Scotland and Ireland, they use peat for fuel. Peat forms in wet areas where vegetable matter only partly decays. Dried out, it burns readily. Coal is nothing more than peat with the addition of millions of years of pressure. When Britain began running out of wood in the 17th century, it exploited its coal resources. Coal was so cheap it helped spark the Industrial Revolution, and coal-powered steam engines displaced water mills as a source of factory power. For lighting, the rich had long used candles, while the poor made do with lamps powered by grease or vegetable oils. But when New Englanders industrialized the whaling industry around the turn of the 19th century, whale oil became the first choice for powering lamps. That is, until light from coal gas, brighter and cheaper yet, was invented a few years later. But coal gas was practicable only in large cities, and whale oil became increasingly expensive as the whales disappeared. Yet another energy crisis was at hand. The answer was petroleum. Edwin Drake sank the first well in 1859, and a vast new source of cheap energy became available. Now, rising demand and shrinking cheap sources have put petroleum where whale oil was 150 years ago. What to do? I would suggest relying on humankind's extraordinary capacity to solve technological problems. After all, that approach has worked pretty well for the last 1.5 million years.
Business historian John Steele Gordon's most recent book is called An Empire of Wealth. You can send us your thoughts online as best. Our homepage is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says Contact. Texas oil man T. Boone Pickens has a new energy plan, one that has nothing to do with oil at all. Pickens announced a plan today to build huge wind farms that he hopes will power most of the country and domestically drilled natural gas to run our cars. But if a gas company rep knocks on your door and offers you $100 an acre to drill your land, you better read the fine print. Ann Murray of WYEP in Pittsburgh offers this case in point.
There's a lot of natural gas under the Appalachian Mountains. Some scientists say maybe $1 trillion were stashed inside a deep layer of rock called the Marcellus Shale. Now that gas prices are skyrocketing, more and more energy companies are heading to Pennsylvania and nearby states to lease land. Tom Murphy works for Penn State University as a farmland advisor. He's heard from lots of baffled landowners in the last couple of years.
What started as dozens of people turned out into hundreds of people, which then turned out to thousands of people.
All these landowners have plenty to ponder. Companies need to drill a mile or more down into this shale. It takes a big chunk of land and a lot of water. For each well, it takes at least 1 million gallons of pressurized water to crack open the rock to get at the gas. Anya Scavage wishes she'd known all that when she and her brother leased their farm for $5 an acre back in 2002. Today she watches workers operate a 100-foot-high drilling rig on her neighbor's land. Nearby sits a water-holding pond the size of an in-ground pool.
I'm just awe-stricken to see how much land is actually absorbed in this process.
Scavage figures it's only a matter of time before drilling begins on her property. The lease she signed 6 years ago won't keep the energy company from using her groundwater or running a maze of pipe across her family's farm.
So we're just kind of at their mercy.
But this is where Penn State's Tom Murphy comes in. He runs a seminar to educate landowners on how to negotiate good deals. people like Ed Hall.
The people that are trying to get the leases, I mean, they got everything in their pocket. And I had no clue.
Nearly 3 million acres have been leased in the region. But within the last 2 years, about 13,000 people have gone through Murphy's seminar. And lease offers have soared from $5 an acre to, in some cases, $2,500 an acre. Murphy says, sure, rising gas prices and the high ratio of successful wells factor into that jump, but he believes it's also because more and more landowners are being educated.
If you think there's only one company out there because only one company knocked at your door, then you're likely to accept whatever that offer might be. So our job is to present those facts.
And a little extra information is paying off. Murphy estimates workshop goers have collectively pulled down about $115 million more than their original offers. After tonight's workshop, Ben Hall's excited. He says he's learned ways to protect his property from environmental damage. He also thinks he'll be able to increase his lease offer by six figures by banding together with neighbors. All in all, a pretty good evening.
It's worth the standing room only because you're only going to get presented this once. If you sign the wrong line, it's forever.
You might think that energy companies are mad at Tom Murphy. On the contrary, he says some reps even show up at his seminars. Companies figure they're paying more for leases, but educated landowners are more comfortable signing on. In State College, Pennsylvania, I'm Ann Murray for Marketplace.
Coming up, designing a market for French modern art.
They are vintage baseball masks, and some are completely used, destroyed. And
how much do you think a work like that would bring?
They're 10,000 euros.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 1.3% today, 152 points to close at 11,384. The Nasdaq soared 2.25%, 51 points, 22.94 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 1.7%, 21 points, ended the day at 1273. Even the big financials stopped bleeding, as I mentioned. Merrill Lynch charged 8% higher. Lehman Brothers picked up almost 7%. Bank of America deposited a nice 9.3% gain. Shares of Alcoa were crushed during the session, but made an uncanny comeback at it. Uncanny, it's an aluminum maker. Better than expected earnings pushed shares up by almost 5.25% in after-hours trading today. PriceSmart wised up by 27%. The Caribbean and Latin American warehouse retailer said net income doubled in the third quarter. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. With food prices on the rise, it's getting tougher to provide healthy meals for kids in federal nutrition programs. The House Education and Labor Committee takes up the issue in Washington. Time to start packing light if you're flying U.S. Airways. First checked bag will cost regular passengers $15. And Elias Howe was born on July 9th, 1819. He invented the sewing machine. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. In Beijing, China, today, the Olympic countdown clocks clicked over to the magic number of 30. There is 1 month left until the opening ceremonies, which means time is getting kind of tight for the city to make sure everything is ready. You've probably read about construction delays and the pollution problems there. We've got Lisa Chow on the line from Beijing now. And Lisa, I was actually there in town a couple of weeks ago. The air pollution was real bad then. Is it any better today with a month to go?
Today was pretty bad. Visibility was incredibly poor. I mean, you know, pretty much driving down most streets, you couldn't see the tops of buildings.
The government has a plan, though, to deal with this pollution, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it has a pretty extensive plan that it's been working on for several months, if not actually a few years now. I mean, it's trying to attack it on three different fronts: the factories and heavy industry, cars, and construction. And right now, in terms of the factories, they're definitely, you know, shutting down factories in four of the neighboring provinces. I mean, actually, back in April, they had announced a plan to at least start giving municipalities targets to reduce pollution. And if they didn't meet those targets, those factories would be shut down. And from what we understand, the state media is reporting in Tianjin, a neighboring city, port city, about 70 miles east of Beijing, they're shutting down 40 factories there. And we're really talking about heavy polluters. So, you know, steel, cement, power plants, concrete mixing plants, you know, stuff like that.
Talk to me about construction for a second, Lisa. It's been going on for years. Is it almost done?
There are 31 venues in the city of Beijing. All of them are complete, yet we really haven't had access to the most important one, which is the Bird's Nest.
And the Bird's Nest is the national stadium, the big one we've seen, right?
Basically, it's going to be the building that everyone sees on TV when they watch the Olympics. And the city, you know, I was walking down one of the main drags in Beijing that goes right through Tiananmen Square. I mean, you still see lots of cranes around the city. Even in Tiananmen Square, there were 8 cranes. And when I was in the square, there was also a bunch of migrant workers who were digging up big holes in the middle of the square to kind of put these metal structures that are going to hold lots and lots of flowers. And it's all for, you know, to kind of beautify Tiananmen Square. But it is scary to see, you know, big gaping holes in the earth a month before the Olympics. But, you know, Beijing operates incredibly fast. So, I mean, I won't be surprised if those holes are covered up next week.
What about infrastructure, subways and things like that?
You know, Beijing has been aggressively expanding its subway lines. There are 3 lines that are actually critical to the Olympics. One is the subway line to the airport. One's that a line that goes directly through the Olympic Green. And another goes through the Central Business District. And all 3 lines have yet to be opened. The Beijing Olympic official that I talked to said these will be open in time before July 20th, which is the drop-dead deadline for all construction.
Well, let me ask you this then. You're sitting there on the ground in Beijing. They're going to get it done?
Well, they have to get it done. I mean, I don't think there's really an option. I think, you know, as I said before, you know, things in Beijing move very, very fast. I mean, in my neighborhood, actually, the subway entrance is right outside my window. And in the last 3 months, there was no entrance. So that's, I mean, it's just really startling how fast they can get things done here.
Lisa Chow in Beijing. Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Kai.
Officials in Paris did something daring today, for them at least. The city council said it's going to think about raising the height limit for buildings in the City of Light to 650 feet. They're currently capped at less than 150. For a country where aesthetics has always been so important, that's no small change. And the French art market is changing too, although not as fast as some would like. The country that's known for producing masters like Monet and Matisse is falling. I can speak French, I promise. Is falling behind in the world of contemporary art. So the government is trying to encourage buyers to think beyond ballerinas and pastel landscapes, as John Larson reports from Paris.
At his Paris studio, artist Mathieu Mercier shows me some work in progress: old catcher's masks that he's going to mount on pedestals and display as if they were tribal art from Africa.
They are vintage baseball masks, and some are completely used, destroyed. And
how much do you think a work like that would bring?
They're €10,000.
Mercier has work in over 200 private collections. He's doing well. But the French contemporary art market has been left behind by Britain and America. And all that new money from Russia and China has pretty much passed France by. Martin Bettenau is the director of the Paris Contemporary Art Fair. He says private collectors have been slow to develop a taste for contemporary art.
When, for example, in the United States, someone becomes rich, he goes to the art of his time. Until the very last years, French collectors went to 18th century furniture or impressionist paintings, the most classical and the most historical.
Overall, the French art market is worth about $12 billion a year. But all that focus on the old masters makes it hard for a new generation of artists. But now there's a real determination to revitalize the modern art scene. Here at the Paris Contemporary Art Museum, a machine that appears to be broken suddenly hurls a glass bottle against a wall at 400 miles an hour, causing delight and anxiety. The opening of this public museum 6 years ago has done much to increase the prestige of contemporary art like this among French collectors. But it hasn't been enough, and now the government's stepping in. Under a proposed law, corporate collectors will get generous tax breaks when they buy work from living artists. French auction houses will be deregulated and guarantee minimum prices, and individuals will be offered interest-free loans. In his apartment crammed with contemporary art, collector Gilles Fuchs, he shows me a work made of black-bound books perched on the rafters like swallows. Before he retired, Fuchs was the director of the Nina Ricci Fashion House. He says the French corporate sector is way behind Switzerland and Germany, for example, where many big companies have important collections. Fuchs believes the new tax breaks will encourage corporations to get out their checkbooks.
When I was president of Nina Ricci, I used to make windows with artists. And every people in the company was interested.
Curators and critics know everything and love nothing, Fuchs tells me with a twinkle in his eye. Private collectors know nothing and love everything. That enthusiasm, as France is recognising, is now worth more than ever. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, an update on the beer wars brewing out in St. Louis. InBev, the Belgian brewer that wants to buy Anheuser-Busch for $46 billion hostile dollars, took out a full-page ad in the Post-Dispatch today. That's the local paper. It promised not only to not cut jobs, but to add new ones. Anheuser-Busch is having none of it, thanks. The company filed suit in federal court today to block that bid. It said the InBev offer is an illegal scheme based on, quote, deceptive conduct. This bud's not for you, I guess. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 152 points, 1.3%. The Nasdaq added 51 points, 2.25%. The S&P 500 bumped up 21 points. That's 1.7%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, making potholes pay in Afghanistan.
It happens all over the country where we've got rough roads. We've got kids, we've got men. Usually we've got kids, you know.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.